Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and this is one of the finest pieces of jazz ever recorded. John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, recorded late in 1964, is more than the masterpiece of a master. In all its musical genius and spiritual depth, it stands today as a timeless moment in jazz, in musical history. Today, a new book on the history of everything that led to and flowed from that evening in a studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. And for us, a chance to reflect on the composing and the performing talent of John Coltrane, the master of the saxophone. Connection listeners, we're talking about the influence and the enduring reverence for one piece of music, Coltrane's A Love Supreme. We'd like to hear from you. How is it that one piece of music can stand so tall as such a combination of talent, history, and spirituality? And where does A Love Supreme fit into your own appreciation of music? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is a man who's distinguished himself with his study and his writing about music. Ashley Kahn did the same sort of in-depth look at Miles Davis with his book, Kind of Blue. His new book is called A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album. Welcome to The Connection.
Thanks, Dick. Nice to be here.
I imagine your work with Davis is a part of what led you to concentrate on John Coltrane because of their own collaboration. Is
absolutely. One door always leads to another, and I'm still sort of pinching myself that I'm the lucky guy who got to focus on, study, celebrate an album that has meant so much to me. Not when I first picked it up, but a little bit afterwards, after I really got to understand the power and the intensity that was in what really is John Coltrane's signature statement.
And I gather from the research that you did that a lot of people react to the music exactly the same way, that it didn't have that oh my God quality for everyone when it was released in 65, that it's grown on a lot of people.
Absolutely. A lot of people who have distinguished themselves by actually recording segments of A Love Supreme themselves and incorporating the lessons, the musical lessons of A Love Supreme into their own musical expression. John McLaughlin, Carlos Santana, Frank Lowe, and various others, all admit that it has taken time for them to really get what Coltrane was doing. But once they got it, it was permanently under the skin.
I want to go to that moment in the late summer of 64. As you describe it in the book, it's when Coltrane's wife Alice is talking about the 5 days when A Love Supreme was actually written, when he put it down on paper. And you have a quote from here in the book. Can I read it?
Please.
It says, "It was like Moses coming down from the mountain. It was so beautiful. He walked down and there was that joy, that peace in his face, tranquility. So I said," this is Alice speaking, "tell me everything. We didn't see you really for 4 or 5 days. He said, "This is the first time that I have received all of the music for what I want to record in a suite. This is the first time I have everything ready.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I mean, at the same time that it sounds so exalted and worthy of ascension, you know, I have this desire to, like, bring that pedestal and slam it down on the ground and say, wait a second, John, your first son had just been born and you left Alice alone with the baby so that you could go off for 5 days and write music? What about the dirty diapers? Couldn't you have helped in some way? But, you know, John Jr. grew up and the dirty diapers disappeared, but, of course, we have something that endured from that that one particular week in like late August, early September.
And Alice Coltrane was very specific in her conversation with you about you being respectful, not only of that time, but of the way that you would manage your own writing about the music, more so than I would have thought, actually.
Oh, well, the Coltrane family is very, very concerned, focused, etc., on the Coltrane legacy, on John Coltrane's music and what he left behind, and even more so with The Love Supreme. They treat that with an incredible amount of reverence, and anyone who's going to approach it is going to have to do it in that same manner. And so I was not surprised at all to hear it. And in fact, my interview tape, 2 hours long as it is, I'm basically still packing up things, and you can hear Alice Coltrane, one more thing. Be honest, you know, be respectful.
And that's not necessarily a commercial type of protection. It's not protecting it as a family investment. It's protecting it for what it represents to them. They're sort of their memory of that man, the musician. Right?
She will not allow it to be connected to any projects like film, TV shows, etc., that have any violence or, you know, wanton behavior, you know, etc., etc. You know, it has to be the right message coming through. Visually, whatever's connected with it, so that it jibes with what Coltrane's message was.
Ashley, let's go back to the music if we can. There is a moment, a change that takes place in the first of the four suites, the one named Acknowledgement, where we actually hear Coltrane's voice on in the recording, which is something unusual, right?
Absolutely. It's the first time he ever did it on record. He would do it only one other time, but when he chants the signature riff, the A Love Supreme four-note sequence, that really is the basis for a lot of what we hear throughout the suite, but definitely the first section, Acknowledgement. It's very much like a soul-bearing, and, I mean, Coltrane had been behind his saxophone and expressed himself to the world through his saxophone for a good 20 years, and he decides to remove the mouthpiece and speak for the first time. It really is an incredible moment.
Actually, somewhere in America at this very moment, someone's driving along in their car listening to A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme, and they're asking themselves, what? It's a piece of music. You know, it's a nice piece of music, but it's a piece of music. So why does it, how does it lift itself out of all the rest and stand so apart?
That's a great question. I mean, basically, it's like one of those things where, the Mona Lisa is a great painting. It looks nice. You know, I wouldn't mind it above the fireplace or whatever, but it's like one of those things that the longer you listen to it, focus on it, let it work with you, you realize that it satisfies on an intellectual level, a spiritual level, a musical level. Head, heart, and soul come away from it in this incredible state of transcendence. I mean, it really does have that effect and endures and reaches people who are not jazz fans, who do not consider themselves music nuts. It really embraces a very large audience. And that in and of itself is an incredible achievement. For Coltrane to set out to do what he really wanted to do, and he states it clearly, plainly in the album liner notes, he says, I'm saying a thank you to God with this album for being able to reach as many people as I've been able to reach, and now I'm going to do it again. And he does do it, and he did it in such a way that here we are, still 35-odd years later, still speaking about it, and it still has that effect on new listeners as well as people who have been listening to it for years.
Now, he didn't actually give a lot of interviews in his short life. He was 40 when he died, right?
That's right.
Was that because he was shy? Is that because people weren't asking the questions?
I don't think he invested much confidence in words, as he did with his saxophone. He felt that everything that he needed to say normally, except for with A Love Supreme, was done through his saxophone, through his music.
We're going to listen just a short clip of John Coltrane, which Ashley's brought in. This is an interview that was done in Japan. Is that right, in 1966?
Just a year before he passed.
He felt that I was Christian.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I am by as far as birth, or my mother was, mm-hmm. and my father was, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And my early teachings were mm-hmm. the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And as upon now, as I look out upon the world, and it's always been a thing with me, to feel that all men know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
See?
I see.
And so therefore I've always felt that even though a man was not a Christian, mm-hmm. he still had to know the truth somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth itself mm-hmm. doesn't have any name on it to
right.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And each man has to find this for himself, I think.
Yeah.
Each man has to find this for himself. In a way, it's part of what he's describing he was shooting for, or he was trying to do, perhaps, with this piece of music.
He was basically saying that, you can be any of any religious persuasion, of any creative bent. You could be doing it with a saxophone in your hand or a shovel or, you know, behind the wheel of a car or whatever. Your relationship with the divine, with the spiritual, supreme being, whatever name you choose, is one that does not preclude anyone.
And context is so important here when we think that this was being done 64, 65. What was going on at that time?
Well, certainly the 60s that we think of the 60s as being this time when spiritual experimentalism was going to explode, but it was still going to. He was coming from the cool, sedate aesthetic of jazz, you know. Sunglasses and, you know, skinny ties and dark suits and whatnot, and, you know, an economy of emotion as well as statement. And here he comes with a soul bearing that just says, you know, I am one with God. I'm going to say it through my music. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of audacity in that. He's using the tools available to him, saxophone, this incredible well-honed quartet, to make a statement to the Almighty. And, you know, I mean, up till then, we think of, like, spiritual statements as necessitating an 80-piece orchestra. And here he's doing it with jazz.
Beginning of the second suite, Resolution. Connection listeners, our number's 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Ashley Kahn. We're talking about John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, Ashley's new book, The Story of John Coltrane's Signature Album. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
From Boston.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This is the beginning of the third suite, Pursuance of A Love Supreme, John Coltrane's signature album, The Man on the Drums, Elvin Jones. Let's listen to a bit. And as a matter of fact, the man who was playing the drums in that recording made in 1964 is on the line with us from New York City in 2003. Elvin Jones, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you for inviting me.
Nice to have you on the program. You wrote in the preface to Ashley's book that you've been waiting for a long, long time at this, for this serious look at this one piece of music.
Yes, because I thought, there's been books written, there's a book written about by the same author, as actually by, Miles Davis, is that kind of blue. And I was just wondering, when is somebody going to write a piece about one of John Coltrane's compositions that, I think that has a great deal more depth of feeling and emotion than a lot of the pieces that I've heard. And I think it's a very remarkable selection of one of his compositions.
Let me ask you something, Elvin. Did the other members of the quartet know on the night that this was being recorded that you were taking part in something special?
No. I know I didn't have any idea about that. All I knew was, I know the music was good, and I know everybody involved always did their best all the time. And so I knew that. And whether it would get lauded, whether anybody would appreciate it at any point, that was beyond my. I didn't try to think that far. as it turned out, it did exactly that.
Mr. Jones, Ashley Kahn here.
Hi.
Hey, man. Listen, one of the things that I always go back to in the preface that you wrote for the book, and I thank you, from very, very sincerely, very humbly for participating in the project, is you mention simply that to know John Coltrane, you have to know A Love Supreme. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, okay, it's a very simple explanation, because I know that A Love Supreme is one of the most popular of the work that we've done, and so what better selection, what better avenue to follow to understand the person himself than to understand what this music is all about. And it's all there in that one composition.
Elvin Jones, it's Dick Gordon here. If I was reading about the piece of music in Ashley's book and about you afterwards, and he writes that for about 10 years or more, you didn't play the music. For about 10 years after the time that it was recorded, after John Coltrane said, you didn't play the music. Nobody played it, like it was so personally attached to John Coltrane. Is that true?
Well, that's true. It was a thing that I had, I suppose, and I still do. If I record something, it takes years sometimes before I'll get enough courage and nerve to listen to it and try to analyze what the things that have been done. And that's just the way I am. I can't. And now it's hard for me to listen to it because I get so emotional. I can't keep from crying.
You can't keep from crying.
That's right.
There definitely is that emotional depth to the music. I should say that Elvin recently celebrated his 75th birthday, and he made part of that celebration at the Blue Note in New York City. Wynton Marsalis was sitting in as a special guest soloist. On the first set, they did Resolution, Part 2 of the suite, and then Pursuance, which we just heard the beginning of. Part 3 of the suite was during the late set. So it seems like Elvin Jones is now reserved preserving the music for very special occasions. It's great to hear that.
Elvin, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be there. I wanted always, especially to hear speak to my friend once again, Ashley Kahn. I wish him all the best, and I hope we will see each other very soon.
Likewise, Elvin. It's a date.
All right.
It's Elvin Jones. That's the man who played drums in that magical quartet with John Coltrane, recording the song A Love Supreme, December 1964. Connection listeners, we're interested in hearing from you about what that music means or meant to you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll go first to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Patrick's on the line. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hearing this music, I have to agree with Elvin. I hadn't listened to this in about a year, but I couldn't help but crying and had to pull off the road and call you.
How far does your connection with this music go back, Patrick?
I guess it goes back about maybe 12 years. I'm 31 years old. I first heard it as an undergraduate in college following a very different life. And this music, particularly Resolution, completely turned upside down my life, completely changed it.
Do you have the words to explain how a piece of music can have that effect on somebody?
It's very hard to describe because my medium is words as an artist. And
you're a writer, are you?
Yes, I am. And I think when I heard that music, it made me wonder immediately. Well, it filled me with awe and emotion and made me wonder, you know, how could somebody do this? Was it self-expression? Was it the filling up of a person, of an empty vessel, you know? How could a person be some sort of connection to something so deep within and so far beyond at the same time that I wanted my own instrument? I thought that if I had not tried to do what he did, I would not live the life. It's truly inspirational, that very piece of music.
Patrick's questions are exactly what went through my mind when I first even considered the idea of taking on the task of doing a book-length study, celebration of let alone Love Supreme, just a piece of music.
You're a writer. Do you have the words?
Yeah, right? Do I have the words? Can I trust myself? Do I have enough confidence that I'll be able to find the words that express what it really, you know, what is the meaning? What is the depth, the nuance, the subtlety, the, you know, why this album, why this piece of music rather than something else? And, you know, I'm just amazed myself that, you know, I was given the opportunity to do this and that I can, that the book is actually done.
But one of the things that you do to find the words, which is quite interesting, is you find people like Patrick, except you're going to, you know, Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead, to Roger McGuinn, to Carlos Santana, to Joni Mitchell, all these people who we look on as serious musical
as
artists.
Well as the Elvin Jones and the McCoy Tyners and the
that's a given.
The jazz world too. The sort of inherent roundtable discussion that is the approach that I've kind of nailed down for both books is exactly that. Trusting other people's words as well as my own and finding a way to weave it all together, because there is no one explanation of what this music means. The truth is going to come from all these different perspectives, you know, in a Rashomon sort of way, is how I feel is the proper approach.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Patrick, thanks for your call. Next to Watertown, Massachusetts, Nikki's on the line. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. You know, I feel inadequate to even try talking about, you know, A Love Supreme, but all I can say, well, you know, I first heard this when I was a kid in New York, on WLIB, which was like one of the country's premier jazz stations. And at the time, I was sitting for a portrait by the painter Ernest Critchlow. And because it goes so back, you know, so far back for me when I was like 12 years old, it has just like all this incredible, you know, resonance. It's like hearing a good performance of Schubert's Quintet in C or Beethoven's Seventh or Ninth Symphonies. And it, you know, it just sort of resonates with every aspect of sort of godly, cultural, and personal goodness that I can think about.
It's not often, Ashley, that the comparisons are made from between a piece of jazz music and a piece of classical music.
Absolutely. Or you know, I mean, there's a completeness and a depth to this musical statement by John Coltrane that is very unusual for any artistic endeavor, music or otherwise. I find that, you know, as I was saying before, it satisfies on so many different levels, but you don't often find that sort of self portrait aspect, the way that Coltrane brings his musical vision and life's mission, I should say, the idea that spiritual and music and artistic and personal can all become one, the idea that music should not just be about Saturday night, that it can be about Sunday morning, that reaching for the divine can happen in a smoky nightclub on a dreary Tuesday night, for that matter, as well as, you know, the way that we compartmentalize it for the Sunday morning services or, you know, depending on your, you know, religious background, maybe Saturday. But, you know, whatever it is, this can all be one and the same. It can happen 24/7. And though he was, as, you know, we heard in that quote from him, that soundbite of John Coltrane himself talking in 66, he was from the church, but he was not of any one church. Mm-hmm. He definitely was reaching for a very universalist type of, or he had a universalist leaning, but he was really reaching for a non-denominational type audience.
Nikki, thanks a lot for your call. We should probably listen to a little bit of the music into the part Pursuance. There's that transition from Tyner to Coltrane sax. You know the one I'm talking about, Ashley?
Oh yeah. That the high intensity handoff, I think, is what I call it in the book.
Listening to that yesterday, the handoff, thinking to myself, all right, you hear that now. You hear that kind of handoff from one jazz musician to another. So I sort of need to be taken back to 1964 and have it put in the context of the music that was being played then, because it wasn't in any way as familiar a move, particularly live, unrehearsed, as this was.
Right. Well, I mean, that sort of telepathic intensity that they had, this quartet, was certainly an achievement that was unlike a lot of almost any other group in jazz at that point. As far as improvised creative music, they were locked into each other almost unlike any other quartet before. And that almost trance-like state that they would get into in their music and live performance, especially in live performance, but then again, to be able to bring that into the studio and distill it down into a 9-minute segment of a suite, as this is, really was you know, part of their magic, what the Coltrane Quartet, and I should identify them, McCoy Tyner on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, Elvin Jones on drums, and of course John Coltrane on the sax. And there was just that brief window of time, no more than 4 years, when they were together and making this magic happen on an almost nightly basis. Yes, it was absolutely revolutionary for its time. Has it become the sound of improvised jazz since? Absolutely. Almost to the point that a lot of critics talk about how jazz seems to have died in a certain sense, you know, with Coltrane in 67. Just the sound of saxophonists in the jazz idiom. There's hardly anyone who can approach either the tenor or the soprano and not quote from that Coltrane vocabulary.
But curiously, you point to that one recording session and the fact that it was all put down on acetate and go one step further and say that it didn't then become a set piece that Coltrane dined out on for months after that.
No, we have to remember, to us, it's a timeless icon. To him, it was just another path in the journey. Call it spiritual journey, call it his musical quest, call it whatever. But a year later, when that album wins 2 Grammy nominations and is called Record of the Year by Downbeat, and he is called Jazzman of the Year by Downbeat, the quartet's breaking up because his experimental path is pushing both McCoy and Elvin out of the band. When 1966 starts, he's got a totally new band, he's doing new things.
Maybe we should just end this little part of the program with some of Jimmy Garrison's bass. This from the end of the Pursuance part of the Suite. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album, is a new book by Ashley Kahn. We're talking about the moment that the music was recorded, what was going on there, particularly with John Coltrane, but also in that time. 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear your stories. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Kettle Cuisine Fresh Soup, traditional and vegetarian refrigerated soups, classically cooked with individually prepared all-natural ingredients, fresh from the source. Varieties listed at freshsoup.com. By Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, serving homestyle Persian cuisine for lunch Monday through Friday, and dinner nightly, valet parking available on the web at lalaroqh.com. And Museum of Fine Arts presenting the photography of Charles Sheeler, rare prints by a major American photographer. On view through February 2nd. Information at mfa.org.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Words, sounds, speech, men, memory, thoughts, fears, and emotions. Time, all related, all made from one, all made in one. Blessed be his name. Thought waves, heat waves, all vibrations, all paths lead to God. Thank you, God. His way, it is so lovely, it is gracious. It is merciful. Thank you, God. One thought can produce millions of vibrations, and they all go back to God. Everything does. Thank you, God.
Pardon Suite, it is called Song. The music is A Love Supreme, and there's a new book out about that music. Ashley Kahn is the author. As a matter of fact, he was just reading the A Love Supreme poem written by John Coltrane, though it doesn't appear at any point in the music. Does it stand?
It does appear in the music. It is the basis of this whole piece. He is basically playing the words through his horn. He's using the cadence, the ebb and flow of normal speech, as the basis for what is a very, what musicians call rubato, not a consistent rhythmic. He's finding the pulse within the melody,
right.
Basically. And I think it's one more example of how he was reaching for as wide an audience as possible and doing things that were so not of the jazz tradition, using words as the basis of his playing.
So and the sequence, Ashley, which came first, the poem or the composition or the music itself?
The poem did. The words form the basis for the music. And that's something that was sort of like an in thing to know about A Love Supreme if you were a musician. And it has slowly become more and more public knowledge. And it just adds, as I was saying before, another level, more depth to the whole project. And one more thing to embrace.
1-800-423-8255. It's our number here at The Connection next to Boston. Harold's calling in. Hi, Harold.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for having this marvelous expression on your show this morning. I first met John Coltrane in 1955 in a record store on Mass Avenue in Boston. He had a pint of bourbon in his pocket. And it was an afternoon, and we were browsing through some Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk's records together. I didn't know who he was. And we proceeded to talk a lot of music, sipped all the bourbon, afterwards hugged each other and said, "Have a good day." I didn't know who he was. When I left the record store, the owner of the shop told me, "Do you know who that man is?" I said, "No." He says, "Well, that's Miles Davis's new tenor saxophonist, and his name is Coltrane." I says, "How about that? He's a sweet dude." And I proceeded to go with some of my fellow brothers that were listening to this music to a club called the 5 o'clock Club, which does no longer exist on Huntington Avenue. And I saw Miles and Train, and Philly Joe Jones, Red Garland, and Paul Chambers. And that's the first time I heard his horn alive, or even on record. It was before he ever was on a record. Needless to say, he made an impact upon me emotionally and musically that was quite revolutionary. And I was to follow his music for the next 8 or 9 or 10 years, up till The Love Supreme. And then, of course, when The Love I had purchased all of his records that were released, or many of them, during that period. My Favorite Things was a very revolutionary expression with the soprano saxophone, which had been in retirement for many years by most modern jazz performers. I had seen that quintet and then found John in his quartets on many occasions in Boston, and then saw him in his sextets. And then The Love Supreme came out. I'm going to quote Dear Elvin Jones. He said, quote, "John Coltrane is an angel on earth," close quote. And now for me to simplify the message that you're imparting today, and thank you for doing it, Duke Ellington would tell you, "We love you madly." It's very simple. John Coltrane was on a spiritual journey long before A Love Supreme, when he listened to people like Lester Young and Bud Powell and Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk. Oh, yes, by the way, I did go to New York and see Monk and Train in 1957 also. So this is, for me, at the age of 65, a total realization that I have been feeling for so long. The language of this music is pure, it's spiritual, and it's right. When I look at what this world is after my 65 years here and see what our political leaders, our religious leaders, our financial leaders, etc., etc., are doing to this planet and to the human race, I choose to continue the rest of my journey along with John and all the other avatars of this marvelous spiritual expression.
Harold, I want to thank you so much for calling in and sharing that with us. 1-800-423-8255 to Cambridge now, and Kate's calling in. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to thank Ashley for writing the book, and thank you guys for having this discussion. It's an awesome book. I read it when it first came out. I also just wanted to get you guys to talk a little bit about Coltrane's his emphasis on practicing his instrument and his dedication. You know, I've read somewhere that people used to say, maybe Alice used to say, that it was 90% saxophone. You know, how much he practiced. And I'm a musician, and that's such a huge he's such a huge inspiration to me in terms of just that constant practicing and dedication to his craft. So I wanted to know if you could speak to that, and I'll take my answer off here.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, actually, I think it was his first wife who called him 90% saxophone, because he used to, you know, come back from the gig and then continue to, you know, practice at home and then fall asleep still in his gig clothes with the saxophone on his chest. I think that, you know, when I look upon, like, the modern masters, the maestros who have come out of the jazz tradition. I'm talking the top three, Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, and John Coltrane. We're not talking about virtuosi. They weren't incredibly given to their instruments from the first step forward. They dedicated themselves to their instruments, to the music, in such a 100% and plus type of fashion that type of rehearsing, that type of practice, definitely for John Coltrane, less so for Miles Davis, but it became such an innate part of his personality that he saw his music as we would look upon eating, breathing, et cetera, et cetera. That type of dedication comes so rarely, and it really has become a model of inspiration for musicians in any genre, in any walk of life, you know, or even creative people. I know that the writer T.C. Boyle, when at some writing convention, I was told, the honored writer was able to choose any hero of his to talk about. T.C. Boyle chose Coltrane. Why? Because of that dedication to his instrument and to his craft.
You know how when you're listening to a piece of music or reading a book, you hit a piece that is just the juice and you go, ah, that's so perfect. And in fact, right at the tail end of your own story about John Coltrane, you get to an interview that you did with Cousin Mary Alexander about their first apartment in Philadelphia and the little chapel beside the church. And to me, you know, it exposes so much. It helps us understand. Can you just tell that story?
Yeah, well, basically, he was practicing incessantly in these Philadelphia row houses that he first moved to when his family moved up from North Carolina. So they're in the big city. They're in these row houses. He's practicing all the time. Of course, the inevitable knock comes and goes, hey, can you stop it, buddy? You know, people are trying to sleep here. So he needs to find a practice place. And where do they find it? Well, at the local African Methodist church. And it just struck me. I mean, that image of a young John Coltrane, 18, 19 years old, rehearsing by himself, given a key to the church, and all that could and did symbolize, and the fact that he was alone with his music, alone with his art, making it all happen within this spiritual confine, just was too good, too perfect. And of course, I thanked Cousin Mary for the story, and I said, I've got my coda. I've got the end of the book right there. And then she added one more little tale that even upped that ante just a little bit more. And I'm not going to say what it is. You got to check that in the book.
the period of time, and it was a short one, from the recording of A Love Supreme to John Coltrane's death is not the happy ending for an artist as highly regarded that you might think, is it?
No. I mean, he was still on his musical path. He was still pushing forward. In fact, the music that he was making at the very end of his life, we're still trying to grasp and understand, because to many unschooled ears, it comes out as being way too dense and way too filled with his sort of energetic approach to the saxophone at that point, that the avant-garde, is the best term we have to describe it now. It's much like James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. You know, we study it. We have college courses on it. Do we fully grasp it? Not yet.
Are you any closer to it for the time that you spent listening to the music, talking to all the people for their appreciation? Did it move you to a closer or a better understanding of either A Love Supreme or what came after?
You know how, where I feel is that the time that I spent intensely focused on A Love Supreme has made me appreciate artistic and creative endeavors in a much more with a deeper appreciation, having my radar attuned to the idea of complete statement. Is this part of a creative vision? Was it just a spur of the moment thing, or was it something that was really reflective of the artist's intent, their personality, where they were coming from, and suddenly, you know, and realizing that there was this connection between the self-portrait that is A Love Supreme and Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, John Lennon's Imagine, and the way that all those pieces of music reflect the creator in such a singular way. They never did it again. They didn't do it before. You know, and yet they stand as these signature landmarks, you know, within the our popular music idiom.
We should take the last minute or so of our program to listen to the last minute or so of the piece, A Love Supreme. This is from where we began this segment of the program. Psalm is the name of the piece. And so we can enjoy it. Ashley, I'll take this opportunity to say thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Dick. It's been a pleasure.
Nice to have you here. Ashley Khan, author of A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album. Earlier in the program, we talked with Elvin Jones, jazz drummer, and the rhythmic pulse behind Coltrane's quartet. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Cassettes and CDs of The Connection are available from WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced. Visit us online at www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287. This is